The 96th Academy Awards airs on Sunday, March 11. And this is Tell Me About Your Father's annual Academy Awards special. Thank you for listening, on which we look at how fathers and father themes appear in the films that are up for Oscars. Fathers weigh heavy on our minds, even when we're not thinking about them. They're that mysterious and impactful. So it's no surprise that they show up prominently in one way or another every year in the films that achieve the movie industry's highest accolades. Film is, after all, one giant way we collectively process emotion alone in the dark. I'm Matthew Philp.
I'm Erin Hosier.
I'm Elizabeth Thompson.
To sum it up, it felt like many of the best film nominees this year struggled to or went to extreme measures to manage the influence of their father figures so that they wouldn't dominate the situation. Some succeeded, some didn't. Fathers in this year's films were either defining the universe and fathering us all, representing far more than just themselves, or they were little men, emotionally stunted, struggling, stuck, almost or already dead. In this episode, we're going to focus mainly on the 10 best film nominations because they encompass almost all of the nominees in all the major categories, with the exception of Danielle Brooks for Best Supporting Actress in The Color Purple, Annette Bening and Jodie Foster in Naiad, and Colman Domingo for Best Actor in Rustin. But speaking of bests, SNL's Bowen Yang recently described our esteemed guest as an inspiration and as evidence for how fun media can be. I paraphrase, but not by much. He's one of our favorite culture writers, Vanity Fair's chief critic, co-host of VF's Little Gold Men podcast, and one of the original conjurers who brought Stevie Nicks to life and ultimately created Fleetwood Mac, Richard Lawson.
Hello. Hello.
King.
Yeah. Making Stevie all those thousands of years ago was really just an honor.
And not even your best work, in my opinion.
And get this, I never saw her in concert.
You never did. No. If you've not read Richard's annual recap of the Oscars from 20 years ago, this happens every year. 2004 was just published this week. Check them out at vanityfair.com. I read yours, Richard, yesterday, the 2004 one. It's amazing what Billy Crystal got away with. I guess I'm not that shocked. But also Billy Bush, what a fucking creep.
So I, when I do this recap, a friend of mine who's a real Oscar obsessive, more than I am even, but he has like either hard copy, like DVDs or digital copies of like every Oscar ceremony since like the 80s. So he sends those to me so I can do the recap. And they always have a bit of like the pre-show. So it's like E! With Joan and Melissa Rivers. Yeah. And then like ABC will have its own half hour like pre-show special. And this year, Billy Bush, famously of the bus with Trump, is like the one of the main correspondents. And it's a year before the bus thing happened. He was an Access Hollywood host. And he is flat out disgusting to every woman he talks to for 30 minutes. It's so awful.
And they're like, ew. But I'll do this because I'm on TV. Like, they're all tolerating him. Well, they're tolerating Joan Rivers, too. People are like, ugh, not you again.
I guess the question I had watching, like, Billy Bush, like, interviewing Lost in Translation star Scarlett Johansson and being like, hey, hey, 19, you're not even 20. That's how he starts his interview with her. I'm like, so 20 years ago, I know it was a different time. It was very pre-Me Too, all that stuff. But, like, but people must have found that creepy then, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I feel like people were always complaining about it, but there was nowhere to complain about it.
Right.
The internet wasn't this, you know, vast cultural discourse and we're angry about what's happening. That was more.
We didn't have the language at that point. I think you make that point too, right, Richard, in it? Jamie Lee Curtis is laughing at like Billy Crystal's lame gay marriage jokes.
Yes.
And it's like, well, I mean, I don't know. I guess she's just getting by.
Yeah, and I think that like people who are like watching Billy Bush on ABC and being like, why is he like groping Renee Zellweger? Why is he, you know, in the back of a car with a 13-year-old girl? Like all that stuff. If complaints were made, the men in charge would just brush it off, right? And nowadays, there's a little bit more accountability. I mean, a little bit more. But yeah, it's just an interesting time capsule that had nothing really to do with the actual Oscars ceremony, but that ended up in the watching of it being the most like disturbingly interesting part of the whole thing.
Richard, where can we see 2004's Oscars ceremony? Can anyone kind of
So the watch ceremony it? Itself, someone put on YouTube. They probably cut some things because of rights issues, like maybe the song performances. That pre-show, I don't know if that exists anywhere but like random tapes like the ones my friend has.
Cool.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, I think really your running joke is Return of the King just wins every single Academy Award that year.
So they had 11 nominations and left with 11 awards. Yep. They had a full sweep of their category.
The Last Emperor in 1988 or something got nine of nine.
It makes for a boring show. I'll say that.
How are your vitamin B levels right now? Like, awards season seems like an endurance test.
You mean vitamin Barbie level?
That is what I meant, actually. Yes.
They're okay. I mean, I always kind of pose this question to friends of mine, colleagues of mine who cover the awards, you know, extensively or more extensively than I do. At this point in the season, what's the one movie you can't wait to never talk about again? And I have to say, I don't have any special animus to that movie, but like, I am ready for Barbie discourse to pass.
Yeah.
And Oppenheimer.
Or marketing.
Yeah. I saw Margot Robbie, I believe it was at the SAG Awards on last Saturday when we're recording this. And, you know, she's been wearing like a pink outfit, a Barbie outfit at every red carpet, you know, for months now. And I'm like, she looked so sick of it. Like, I think she's ready to move on. I think we all are.
The SAG gown was horrid.
It was also not a good gown. Yeah. So I think Barbie, but like, other than that, you know, I genuinely like, I think it's a really good crop of Best Picture nominees. You know, we've seen a lot of changes in the Academy's makeup, whether it's much more international than it was just 10 years ago. So you see things like Zone of Interest, smaller movies like Past Lives, getting the kind of consideration that they wouldn't have, you know, in the older days. I mean, granted, there are now 10 Best Picture nominees versus 5, so that changes things too. But yeah, I mean, getting Anatomy of a Fall, all the nominations it got, et cetera, like that's exciting. So it's not a year where I'm like really rolling my eyes.
Like, foreign language films are no longer just quarantined to foreign language.
In fact, we don't even call them foreign language. We call them international features.
International features, that's right. Before we get to the Best Picture nominees and the themes that go through them, and Richard, your picks, I want to talk about snubs. Mm. I feel like we don't use the word snub at any other time of the year except around Oscar season. And a lot of the discourse this year was about snubs. I mean, the biggest one, of course, Barbie, Greta Gerwig, and Margot Robbie not receiving nominations. Paul Mescal, Andrew Scott, and Andrew Hayes, All of Us Strangers, which got a ton of Euro Awards, but nothing at the Academy Awards. Yeah. Lovely film. Very much on theme for us. Sadly, that's not one of the best film nominees. But who was your worst snub this year who did not get recognized, or what film do you wish had been nominated?
I mean, I would say May December.
May December was... That was what I was going to say.
Yeah, I just think it's such a good movie. It was my favorite movie of 2023. It kind of rose above Past Lives on a second watch, and I was like, wait, this movie is not only so thoughtful and interesting and weird, but also it's just so entertaining and so beautifully acted. I'm glad the screenplay is nominated, that I was worried that it wouldn't get anything. Yep. But the Academy, historically, is just really weird about Todd Haynes movies. And when I say really weird, homophobic. Mm-hmm. They don't like how gay his movie or queer his movies are. They just don't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Erin, you were going to say the same thing?
I was going to follow that too with, I saw it more. I had to see it more than once to really sort of like, it's not something that you could watch when you're in like a weird mood, or you can look away for a while, or if you're feeling testy about your taste in music, which was the part of the film I didn't love. But that's a very small thing when you're talking about like Charles Melton and his performance of a father who was made a father at the hands of his abuser, played by Julianne Moore. And this is a story, of course, based on the Mary Kay Letourneau case of the 90s, where she's a teacher. And in this story, Joe, the student who she later marries after she gets out of prison for 8 years, is 13 years old. And so you're really getting into the head of these characters. Julianne Moore plays the pedophile in question, and she's fascinating and layered and kind of horrible and manipulative. And then Natalie Portman plays the actress that is going to play her on screen. And she is, you know, a predator in her own way, as actors can be. And maybe that's why also, you know, Hollywood has a problem with this film. But
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
It also, you know, is about women as predators. The writing was so careful and nuanced. And there's this one little scene where Joe and his teenage son, who's about to go off to college, are like up on the rooftop, just kind of like father-son bonding. And son brings out the marijuana. And Joe's like, oh, I never smoke marijuana. And after a while, you know, he's like, oh, let me have some of that with his son. And his son says, Dad, you don't have to. And it just like struck me. There's so many scenes where characters are trying to say to Joe, like, you know, are you really okay saying yes to this? And it's this portrait of the man who's never had agency or is really questioning that. It's so interesting for the purposes of our podcast, but also as any drama.
You know what I found fascinating? As you were saying that, I'm like thinking about Ta from last year, thinking about this film. It's interesting in this like post Me Too era that we're examining this by portraying women as predators. It's like, how do you even tell the story of Harvey Weinstein without people going, God, we've heard it? Or like, what are you saying that's new? It's like,
yeah.
And watching that scene with Julianne Moore and Charles Melton, where he's like, but maybe I was too young to make that decision. And she's like, and then you watch her enact the abuse by saying, you had all the power, like gaslighting it.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful film too, because Charles Melton, like Riverdale, like who gives a shit, you know, he's just hot. And what an absolute evolution for him.
I was surprised by his, how young he came off on screen. And he's a 33-year-old man. Yeah.
I thought that was so well done. Yes. And I thought that really came through in that top scene, because on the one hand, he's sort of, it's a really sweet and sad scene, because he's telling his son in so many ways, like, are you okay? Like, was this an okay experience for you?
Yeah.
I'm sorry if this was an uncomfortable upbringing for you. But then you also see his son trying to protect him, and you almost get the sense that they're the same age, because he's so sort of stunted as like a frozen teenage boy or child. But Aaron, like, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. And we were talking about this, Richard. I don't know if you saw this piece came out in the New York Times by Mark Harris earlier this week about the depictions of women, of mothers in movies this past year, and men's relationships to their mothers. And the headline is, what if mom's not to blame? We put it on our Instagram, and in the caption, Aaron notes, like, maybe the reason this movie isn't nominated is because we cannot accept the depiction of mom as a child predator, child molester. We have to see men as abusers and dads.
Yeah. And I think that, like, using the word brave about like any movie making is maybe a little silly, but like, I think both Tar and May December share interesting DNA, where it's like a movie like May December, in the kind of dumb social media, quick to judgment kind of culture we live in, that's a pretty risky movie to even put out, let alone for Netflix to buy, you know? And I really, I think it's kind of a little miracle that it exists, because it is dealing with really tricky things. It's putting certain tropes kind of on their head, or, you know, gender reversal, what we're used to. And I think, and it's asking a lot of interesting questions, and also in the form of Julianne Moore, asking us to be at least in some part sympathetic to this woman who did a terrible thing and then continued to do it for a number of years. I really value I think you're right, Elizabeth, that like that particular kind of complexity that feels a little bit like it's touching a third rail, the Academy got, I think, kind of spooked by it, or just sort of willfully was like, I don't get it, whatever, and dismissed it, because it's asking you to do an extra bit of sort of compassion and thinking.
Yeah.
I also just love that they drew a line between Black Swan and this for Natalie Portman.
Sure.
It's like, you know that that's part of the reason, but she's like this maniacal, myopic, psychotic person who will get it. You know, Joan Crawford for our generation, but without maybe all of the OCD. Two things in terms of snubs. Firstly, the 11-year-old in Anatomy of a Fool.
Incredible.
Milo Mercado Greno really gave Timothy Chalamet a run for his money on the close-up tear shots. Plus the dog. I mean, the dog.
Yeah.
The dog
was dead with its eye, you know, and then it, like, how the fuck do they do that?
Most upsetting injury for me in the film was the dog.
Yeah. I watched it with my partner, Scott, and we knew it was going to happen, and he saw the dog, and Scott just goes, no, why? Just like 4 minutes before it happened. But like that kid calling out, fucking help me, to this minder who couldn't help him. The maturity in that was just something else, truly. but also All of Us Strangers, which I thought was inconsistent, and I didn't love the ending, but mm-hmm. I absolutely loved their performances. I loved Andrew Scott.
Mm.
As someone whose father died, I was deeply affected mm-hmm. by the scenes in it as individual scenes, maybe not as a whole film, but like I remember seeing him say to his father, "It's okay, Dad." And I felt glad to know that scene alone existed.
Wow.
You know what I mean? But I don't know that it should have won an Academy Award, got an Academy Award nomination, but I guess...
The acting could have, I think.
Yeah. I don't think it's not Andrew Hay's best
no.
by any stretch. And I love everything Andrew Hay's done, truly. But I was torn with it. Wait, so here's another question. Speaking of Todd Haynes and speaking of, well, actually not speaking of Annette Bening, which I think is the point. What do you think is better, being nominated and winning or having people talk about your film and impacting culture, but you did not get nominated? So would you rather be Charles Melton as the trapped young father in Todd Haynes' May December or Annette Bening as the 60-year-old marathon swimmer Diana Nyad in Nyad this year? Would you rather be Emerald Fennell or, you know?
You're asking, would I rather Charles Melton played Nyad?
Yes, thank you.
And
I
the
was
answer
really
to that is
certain.
Yes. And I wish that Annette Bening had played Joe.
Yes, thank you. Wearing a giant fake mustache. Yeah.
And, exactly. Like an old circus performer. I think there are different schools of thought on that. I talked to some people, including a producer on May December, who didn't make a declarative statement on this, but was sort of mulling over the deal, like, is it maybe ultimately better for him at this stage in his career that he didn't get the nomination because maybe that's too much too fast and it kind of puts this weird mark on it, sort of elevates you into a level of role that maybe isn't the best fit for him. I don't know. But then at the same time, if you get the nomination, even if you don't win, there's always that sort of thing before your name and movie trailers and whatever, you know, Academy Award nominee. And it does open some doors, but I think it sometimes closes them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you guys, Aaron, Elizabeth? What do you think? Would you rather be Emerald Fennell and everyone talking about your insane movie that doesn't make sense?
I think all actors are lying if they say that they don't want to win the Academy Award, mm-hmm. even when oftentimes it's kind of the kiss of death and you might not work again, or at least for a lot of money like you deserve. I will say that Emma Stone clapped a little too hard for Lily Gladstone at the SAG Awards when Lily was named the winner instead of Emma. And they've been neck and neck, and I can't wait to hear what you think's going to happen, Richard. But actors. I also don't think that two novelists should be in a marriage either of Anatomy of the Fall, which is why that wasn't a mystery to me, but we can talk later about that film.
Yeah.
Busy? Quality?
Quality?
I think I wouldn't want to be our girl, Emerald, but for many reasons. And
she's still our girl, but you don't want to be.
She's still our number one. But no, I think I would rather want everyone talking about me than, because it can be the kiss of death, as Richard and Aaron mentioned. But
the other thing is, if you are nominated, it's a lot of fucking work. If mm-hmm. you want it, your people are going to send you out to every goddamn event you have, you know, like every screening, you know, every Q&A. And if you don't get the nomination, you just have this halo of, oh, that you got robbed. They just didn't understand it. They don't understand how good you are. You know,
you get Glenn Close.
I don't think Charles Melton was feeling that way that morning of the nominations. I'm sure he was pretty disappointed. But that's also partly the fault of people like me who have been gassing that up for months and being like, oh, it's a lock. He's definitely getting nominated. And then, whoops, sorry.
But I guess the upside of if you are Jacob Elordi, if you are Charles Melton, no one expected anything of you. And now you have this buzz and people are like, there is no doubt these two guys are super talented. They have their whole careers ahead of them. Whereas I think people are, I mean, not to be cruel, I mean, maybe this is inaccurate, but I think Annette Bening, it's not thank you for playing Oscar for her. But it's like, I mean, no one is excited about Nyad. I didn't even know it was a film until 6 months ago. And it was out all last year or whatever the hell.
Do you know who I want to talk about? The Iron Claw. I felt that Zac Efron was a very, very generous and good supporting actor. And I felt that he should have at least been nominated for something. I really enjoyed his performance. I thought he was really good.
I've always liked him. I've always thought he was very talented. I learned about water from him. His series on the Earth.
Concept of water?
No. I learned about, because he did a whole two seasons with some fucking LA guru dude. But he's constantly stoned, but he teaches you about the world. He travels all over the world and he goes to France and he learns about water and learns that. And there's a water sommelier in LA, does this scene with Anna Kendrick. It's hilarious, where they're tasting waters. And she's like, I'm not sure this is really a thing, but you're my friend, so I'll do the scene. Anyway, I learned you should never drink distilled water because it leaches minerals out of you.
Wow.
Like, I learned from him. Anyway, I think he's a great actor. I don't know. Maybe he's going to be Tom Cruise, though. Do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think that this opened a door to something, you know. You know, it's funny. When I was watching The Iron Claw, I was thinking about you three, and I was like, this could be called Tell Me About Your Father, the movie.
Totally.
Like, it's such a, like, dad movie. You know, not for dads, but about dads. I think that what happened with that movie, which is, you know, partly strategy error and partly just kind of how things go, is that, you know, it's the highest grossing A24 movie ever. It did very well commercially for a smaller film. I think they just released it too late. I think that if it had been at one of the fall festivals and then had like a good like November-ish run, maybe a kind of counter-programming Thanksgiving movie, I think it would have been stickier in voters' minds. And I think you would have seen more momentum for Efron, or, you know, maybe the movie as a whole.
Right. I thought it was a contender for this year, not last year.
Oh, right. Exactly. Because it came out right at the end of the year.
Right.
And sometimes that works, but I think increasingly you need the sort of, I mean, you need social media momentum, I think, honestly. Yeah. Like, we're not far away from a fully TikTok awards campaign, you know? Like, I think Saltburn probably got close because it was such a big thing on TikTok.
What was her name? Leslie?
To Leslie, with the Andrea Riseborough film. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where the whole thing got revived because of social media.
Well, it was social media, but it was also a sort of like, I don't imply sinister intent by using this word, but a sort of cabal of Hollywood people who were hosting screenings at their homes. And then the Academy had to kind of be like, oh, we need to change some of these campaigning rules, because it was a little bit, there was some sort of question about how, like, if this was like above board, the way that they kind of did this like shadow campaign for that movie. Yeah.
If you're sitting there wondering what you could add to the experience of listening to this podcast, may I suggest that you rate and or review us on Apple Podcasts? It's a very simple and easy process involving just a few screen taps and kind intentions. Reviews and ratings help us out a lot, and they make it so that we love you, our listeners, even more. Let's move on to themes in the best film category. Here's the metaphor. I don't know if you guys have ever been in a meeting with a bunch of straight dudes, and there's always like in a corporate sitting, but there's always like a woman, maybe you are the women who do this. It's their job to not only be in the meeting, but also to manage the men from talking over each other, from changing the subject, from like being just distracted and throwing a football around. I've been in so many of these meetings where I've watched women do everything backwards and in heels. I feel like fathers in a lot of these stories and their presence was kind of managed in a similar way to straight men in those meetings. Because Anatomy of a Fall, right, it's not about the father. And in fact, you don't even see him for like 45 minutes. It's about Sandra Hüller's character. And when he is finally brought in, she enacts this like speech and they have that extraordinary argument scene. But if he'd been there the whole time, it would have been more about their own relationship. So he had to kind of be kept out. American Fiction's the same thing. Father's already dead. They're not even that really tied up in what he did to them. It was all pretty standard stuff. He was a jerk. He wasn't around and he philandered. They're all a bit over it. They all knew. They don't really care. He had to be dead. I thought for a while, Biz, you texted and you're like, oh, there's a lot of two great father speeches in this. And I'm like, oh, there's going to be a confrontation between like Monk and his father. But then I found out he was actually dead. So it's like, they're keeping him at bay. Bella Baxter, you know, she has to leave so that her father, his trauma, which he admirably is trying to halt, isn't like somehow the most dominating thing. So it's like, in order to tell these stories, we had to get fathers out of the way, because they cannot simply be in a room and be reasonable. They can't be in a plot and be reasonable. Zone of Interest too. The father's the entry point, but we're so far away from him, we can't really get a sense of him so much. We don't go to work with him, thank God, and we don't really get into his head, but he's how we get into the story.
Maestro, too?
Well, I mean, that's a weird thing, because there's another series of these films where it's like they present interesting women making interesting decisions in interesting situations. This one failed at it. Maestro failed because Felicia's the main character. Let's talk about her. Oops, no, let's just pivot to Bradley Cooper doing drag for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, like they didn't get that story under control. They'd answered no questions about her and they just restated things about him. So I don't know. What do you think about that? Is that a coherent point to make?
Yeah, I think
so. Did you feel like it's interesting that we're treating fathers in films like badly behaved teenagers is my point. Yes.
Yeah, I think that the father in Anatomy of a Fall is interesting because, like you said, we don't see him for a while, you know, pretty far into the movie. And then you get these kind of two defining scenes with him, this incredible argument scene where I feel like it's pretty evenly matched, but because we've spent more time with her, I'm sort of like more on her side in that argument. But like I see his points. And so you kind of see a marriage that is imbalanced in certain ways, but kind of interestingly balanced in others. And then you have the scene with the kid in the car, right? Like,
yes.
And you get this impression that like, oh, for the kid, he was the easier parent. Mm-hmm. And now he's left with the more difficult, not erratic. She's not irrational, but like she's a bit pricklier and maybe chillier. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's just a boy and his dad kind of thing. I, you know, I don't know. You could look at it a lot of different ways. I mean, that kid's definitely not straight. But yeah, I think that movie handles it really interestingly. It's about a dad's death, but it's not about him. It's not really about the hole that he left. It's like...
No.
Yeah.
It's about the child at the end.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, this whole thing is about that car scene, father handing all the power to the kid. And he's like, it's actually about him. It's not even about... It changes from being about Sandra Hüller to being... Sorry, that's the actors. I'm not even saying the character's name. But to the boy who makes a decision, the pivotal decision about how his life will continue and how her life will continue. And he even defines truth for the public. Like it's a kind of fascinating throw to a kid, really.
Yeah. That's such a good point, Richard, about like the little boy in the movie is left with the colder parent and the parent that has a more complicated relationship with him. And I think that movie, I did side with her. I thought it was a great depiction of jealousy and competition. Your point, Erin, that two writers should never be married or two. I mean,
especially novelists or memoirists.
Yes, absolutely. But he in the end, to me, definitely kind of came off as like a whiny wiener boy, for lack of a better phrase. Like,
yeah.
And also an anger I felt for leaving the son, for leaving, for checking out, for doing what he did.
The exchange of gender roles, just like flipping.
Yes, and then the incredible responsibility that's then left on, you know, an 11-year-old to understand infidelity, et cetera, all of the ugliness that comes out in that courtroom, and then make the decision to preserve the family. Like, just tremendous weight put on his shoulders. But yeah, I think it's true, Matt and Richard, that he had to be removed to do that, for that weight to be made.
Yeah. Last year, everything was about notable presence or absence of fathers. So the best film nominees this year, there were like a series of these like sweeping, grand, often operatic portraits of iconic fathers in quotation marks, like men and actual fathers who represent much larger cultural moments that were symbols of their time and they represent human achievement beyond like the mere person. So, you know, Maestro, Leonard Bernstein, a father of 20th century music, Oppenheimer, father of atomic energy. I think Killers of the Flower Moon is a movie in that category too, to a certain extent, because it's a portrait of patriarchy playing out in a certain unusual context. I think it would have been better if it had been about Lily Gladstone's character, but like if we literally knew anything about why this woman made any of these decisions or any of the Native American women allowed these men in, seeing as they had the power. So this is like Scorsese critiquing white patriarchy, rust into Coleman Domingo as like a kind of father-like activist. And I think Zone of Interest, where the father, as I was saying before, like is the kind of symbol into that story, the much larger story of how we live next to chaos. What do we all think it says about us as people that we're telling stories about who we are as a race through biopics about our great father figures this year? Like, it feels a bit, to me, apocalyptic.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Why are we examining ourselves in this way?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, Richard's review of The Zone of Interest, I think, hit the nail on the head in that he's talking not to speak about you like you're not here, Richard, but he references, you know, the banality of evil, like the discourse around the banality of evil that is that film. And in my opinion of that, if we're going to talk about the father and zone of interest, is the industry behind mass death and mass murder and his blueprint for a more effective crematorium. Like, that's the extent of what we see. And then when we go into the future, it's the same banality too. So I just felt like it was such a good way, and a sad way, but a needed way of talking about just our collective indifference toward the horrors that are still incredibly relevant right now.
Right, now, totally.
And there's a lot of analysis in some in these movies about how we got here, right? Like what is the origin of X, you know, and what Oppenheimer did, you know, brought us into a different age of like geopolitical consciousness and all this stuff. And obviously what was wrought in Killers of the Flower Moon, like this is Martin Scorsese looking back. He's gone back further in time, but like, this is like, okay, why am I so obsessed with violent men? Like what, and greed? Like, what is that? Like, let's look at one of America's original sins that kind of created this. So I think, yeah, you're right, Matthew. There is something sort of like, well, you know, we're about at 11:30, midnight's about to hit. Like, we're all going to shuffle off this mortal coil together.
That's what I thought.
Let's kind of figure out what we did wrong. And it's interesting that it's men, it's straight white men doing that kind of introspection. And I kind of, in an optimistic way, want to think that that is because they have been pushed a little bit in that direction. Men would rather do blank than go to therapy. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'd rather make Oppenheimer than have Christopher Nolan. I don't know if maybe he's in therapy, but like, be like, why am I so obsessed with making the biggest, most world dominating thing in his case, movies, in Oppenheimer's case, a bomb. And I don't know, maybe that it means that men are like straight men are actually like really mulling things over because the culture, as annoying as it can be sometimes, has kind of prodded them in that direction.
Yeah.
I mean, you said about this, Richard, you wrote about Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer is not a film that exists to demonstrate the might of the bomb. It is more of a fraught character piece than perhaps the advertising has suggested, as concerned with what happened to Oppenheimer after the war as it is with what he built during it. And I thought, actually, it was really a portrait of this machine that operates with no individual in mind. Einstein warns him. He's like, oh, they'll revere you. They'll then throw you out and demonize you. Then they'll bring you back in a couple of decades and give you a medal, but it won't be about you. It'll be about them. And then as the movie's playing out, like Robert Downey Jr., the senator, is ousted to show that nobody is safe from this machine, this huge patriarchal machine that exists for us only, really. We created it, like the bomb, I guess.
Yeah. It was a strange film, though. Oppenheimer left me cold, like literally. Like, I nodded off a couple times amidst all the sound problems in the IMAX theater that I was in. I was so surprised that there wasn't like any emotion anywhere. I mean, looking back, why would there be? It's about how cold and unfeeling an atomic bomb is. But I don't know, Richard, do you know what I'm saying here? Like, have you heard anyone say, like, I don't know, could there have been any documentation of like human mass death that's changing the world as human beings?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was definitely a criticism of Oppenheimer that was like, why don't we have any sort of sense of the human beings who were most immediately affected by this in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I think if they had included that, it's a very different movie. Mm-hmm. You know, if it almost becomes a kind of 70s disaster film where we're following a multiple array of characters. Some of them are in Japan and we know what's about to happen to them, you know, and I think that would have pulled the movie in a different direction. I think what Nolan is really looking at is, like Matthew said, the kind of machine of it, but also this kind of like, what is personal drive and when is it masked by like, well, no, I have a duty, I have a mission. And it's like, well, sure, yes, that we were at war, it was a serious time, and it was kind of, they were doing something to sort of get there before the Germans did, because God knows what they would have done with that technology. And yet I think the movie also kind of understands, and maybe Nolan understands about himself, that a lot of this is choice. You know, this isn't mandate, really, what these people are doing, how these men have organized themselves, be it in the invention of the bomb or in government. And I think it's looking at, like, the mechanics of that and trying in a kind of blockbustery way to pick that apart. I don't think it fully succeeds. I think the last part after the bomb is invented and it's all the government stuff, I think that gets a little bit, you know, dense in a bad way. And I had trouble following it. And Aaron, I kind of left feeling not as rattled or roused as I thought I would. But there's definitely something in there with Nolan, like, okay, so I made Dunkirk. It was a big war movie. Like Spielberg, I was supposed to win an Oscar for it. Best director. It didn't happen. And then he kind of dug a little deeper into like his own obsessions in a movie about a kind of obsession.
Yeah.
Well, nice. I mean, I wonder if he'll do an Oliver Stone trilogy, you know, like Platoon, Born on the 4th of July and Heaven and Earth. Maybe he will go to and do an examination of
that's true.
Japan.
The thinking man's Oliver Stone.
Thinking man's Oliver Stone.
But it's Batman. It's Christian Bale's Batman in Japan.
Great. Well, you need an entry point.
Yeah.
And there's a time machine and they go to space. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
Great.
I also think just quickly on that note about what you said, Richard, about like, if you know, men don't go to therapy, so they do X, Y, Z. Like, same, just quickly to like Killers of the Flower Moon, which you alluded to before, Matt, a beautiful movie, but I think you summed it up great, Richard, in your review where you say not enough space is provided to restoring palpable personhood to people so relentlessly robbed of it, that we could have spent more time with Molly, of a movie that is intended to be about the personhood of these people that were murdered or had family members murdered. There's not enough of them in it, I felt, and the sort of failure on Scorsese's part to...
It's such a glaring failure.
Yeah. I mean, there were some people who were like, well, do you really want to see Martin Scorsese make that movie? You know, that's very much not own voices, to use a publishing term.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think Scorsese has proven himself a thoughtful person in the past enough that I think that he probably could have done it. Not, you know, not perfectly, and people still would have been mad about it. Why are you telling a story? You should, someone else, you know, more closely related to this should tell it. So yeah, it feels more like an unforced error of film. I mean, because the backstory with that movie is that initially the book is just as much about the formation of the FBI as it is about this particular murder case. Right. And that was the original plan for the movie. And Leonardo DiCaprio was going to play the Jesse Plemons role. He was going to be the intrepid FBI investigator. And then there was some, you know, understandable concern about that. And so then they worked with the Osage community and they retrained the gaze of the film to what it is now. I think they didn't go far enough, you know.
Yeah.
It ultimately plays as a bad, I mean, it's a Batman movie and that's, you know, that's a worthy movie to make. But it's like a bad proxy dad movie, you know, in the DiCaprio-De Niro relationship.
Yeah,
And then Lily Gladstone and her family are sick in bed. So kind of not active in the story or being killed, you know, and I just don't think that movie found the right in, even though they really did try and rethink things along the way.
I mean, you have to give Scorsese credit to a certain extent. The copy that you would have seen just before the credits telling you what happened, the stat or whatever, he put himself on the stage and read it to the audience himself rather than distance. I mean, I feel like he kind of wanted to be, I don't know, accountable for this story. He wanted to be like, this is important. I'm going to talk to you directly. So I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's like he went to therapy a little. Like, I feel like I can't, I just don't believe he's not in therapy. I just don't.
Did you all see The Irishman, his last movie?
Yeah, that was a 17-act play that never ended. But it, sort in shifts, actually.
But it has this interesting conclusion where it's like this old mobster who maybe is telling tales or maybe he really did kill Jimmy Hoffa, who knows, who's just alone in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And it's Scorsese being like, this obsession I had with these guys and Goodfellas and Casino and just violent men, like it all just leads to where we're all mortal. You know, it could have played well as a final film in his career. Like that was his last statement. He's rounding the bend and saying like, maybe I was a little bit foolish to have accidentally venerated gangsters, because people watch Goodfellas and they're like, cool, they're cool guys. And it's like, that's not really the point of the movie, but maybe the style kind of made. So it's interesting that after this kind of definitive kind of almost closing statement, he then made this. I think maybe he felt emboldened that like, okay, like I've turned a corner. I'm able to tell new stories, and yet his forever impulses pulled him back in the making of that film to a violent man movie that doesn't make anyone look cool. That's an advancement in his style, but like it's still, he can't get out from under these particular interests that he's had for, you know, 50 years.
Speaking of that, I know that there'll be an opera version of the dialogue about Barbie at this point, which is what happens when you have nothing else, like you do opera, an opera about something. I think it's a biopic, even if it's about an iconic
adaptation versus, yeah. Are we talking screenplay of Barbie?
I mean, the film itself is like, let's talk about this in a way we've never seen it before. To be fair, Mattel has been doing Barbie Life in the Dreamhouse, the animated series, which is very self-aware and meta on YouTube for years, and it's hilarious.
Sure.
But I just, but also the thing is about, no, and have you guys not watched this? It's really, it's so fucking funny. It's a complete satire of itself. So like, that is a film about women managing, triumphing over patriarchal tyranny and toxic masculinity, but they don't really break free of it at all. Like, I think about this in terms of Marcy Bianco's book, Breaking Free, a guest that we had on earlier this year, talking about equality is not an aspirate. It's not something to aspire to, because how do you define equality? It's defined by the people who have power. So they didn't go and break free. They just sort of went, oh, let's talk about things a bit.
Yeah.
Does it pass the Bechdel test? That's a question.
I think so. I think it was such an ambitious thing to introduce the concept of patriarchy and feminism to little girls and really society anew, and even adult men. And through the genius performance of Ryan Gosling as Ken, you know, I just feel like we leapt ahead, at least in our vernacular, a good 10, 20 years. I feel like Barbie is what we were trying to do since the 90s. We, you know, the Riot Girls and Bikini Kill, and along comes Greta Gerwig and, frankly, Margot Robbie. Like, when that was announced, or on the heels of years of like Barbie's in development for Sony or whatever it was, and Amy Schumer. And so then you get in this framework like, oh, it's going to be about body image. And then I just was so pleasantly surprised at how funny the movie is, how warm. Mm-hmm. I thought the big Barbie speech that America Ferrera is nominated for was kind of like, you know, I've heard it before, but I was so excited that it actually like roused people and seemed to, I don't know. It was a great script. And I was really surprised, not that Margot wasn't nominated for actress. I don't think she should have been. She was sort of born into the role. It's amazing. And such a wink that she literally is Barbie physically. Right. What Greta Gerwig with her partner, Noah Baumbach, did with the script was just entirely fresh.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, Aaron, that it was so, the big speech that everyone keeps pointing to, frankly, felt a little ChatGPT written to me.
I wasn't that moved by it.
I didn't think that anything was said that was that interesting or new, but I loved, everyone knows the horror of watching a straight man pull out a guitar, you know, or everyone knows like the little
to play little
visual sight gags in that movie were, and how they were deployed were so brilliant. I thought, I really was just so delighted by the movie the first time I saw it and laughed so much. I thought it was so good.
You make a good point, Aaron, about like the social utility of the movie. It's hard, like in my line of work, where I see something like that and I'm like, oh, come on. Like, what? That's like, that was on Tumblr 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, you know? it's the cool girl speech from Gone Girl, you know? That's not a speech. It's a piece of writing, but whatever. But like younger audiences or people who otherwise tune that out, like there it was in a movie that everyone went to go see. And that's great. And I also think that something that people, I haven't heard spoken about that movie for obvious reasons, it has more sort of pertinent social topics that people want to, you know, talk about. But like, I love that toward the end of the film, it gets into this kind of dreamy metaphysical thing about existence. And in that, like, is like, yes, it's a movie about men and it's a movie about women, but it's also about one person and then therefore all of us and like our individuality and how we fit in the world and all the stuff with, you know, Rhea Perlman and, you know, the song, the Billie Eilish song, like, what was I made for? Like, I think that also is a great thing to sort of like pry open kids' minds a little bit and be like, you know, as you get older, you're going to start thinking about like your place in the world and how you fit in and what your consciousness is like versus that of others. And I thought that that was great in addition. And I think that yes, there's not a conclusion in the movie. It's not sort of imparting a lesson specifically. It's just allowing the audiences who most need it the room to kind of open their eyes and think a little bit. And I like that.
Yeah. I can't wait for Charlie, my nephew, to see it. He's too young. He's 7. But I'm so excited that this movie exists for the 10 to 18 year olds.
I'm glad that this film exists in this sense, because it's so much about a female perspective. And so every single other film is entirely about celebrating men and men's achievement as somehow symbolic of everything that we are as people. I also think it's weird hearing the Swiftie version of fans of this film who were enraged that it wasn't nominated. They weren't nominated. And it's it did get how many? 8 nominations?
It got 8. And so isn't Margot Robbie is a producer, so she is up for Best Picture.
She's one of the nominees. Yeah. She was the driving force behind that movie, you know. And
she
is getting recognized for, I think, probably the harder job that she did on that movie, which is the producing of it, not necessarily the acting in it.
Right.
Look, a movie does not make $1.5 billion without a lot of men and boys seeing it. So whether it opened their eyes or changed their minds or their hearts or whatever, I don't know. But it's a piece of commercial filmmaking that also, which is not that common, actually has a sort of purpose behind it that also isn't too didactic, one sort of clunky-ish speech, aside.
Let's just ricochet to the other end of the emotional spectrum and go to the films that, and some of the films cross over, in my opinion, delicate, intimate stories that included important father figures, where everything is about the messiness of these relationships characterized by the weakness and failure of men. I'm thinking about The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, to Poor Things, Anatomy of a Fall is very much about that. I think American Fiction, for reasons that we already talked about, the father's dead, he's not even there anymore. Holdovers particularly, because Paul Giamatti's character is a very, very cocky, puffed up, sort of almost sadistic teacher who revels in having a power over people who can't question him, lecturing them on how they should be living in this very aspirational way, something he's entirely failed to do himself. And this idea that he is simply due this respect by virtue of the job, this very average job that he has, is so dad energy to me. It's like the epitome of dad energy. And then, of course, he becomes a proxy dad to the main character as they're left by themselves. The main character's father is in an asylum and can't be his father. So it's like super fathery, everyone's failing emotionally. That's it, on a very intimate level.
Yeah, and it's about the bittersweetness of raising a child, which is like, I want them to have more than I had. Mm. I want them to do better than I did. But that also kind of fucking sucks at the same time. You know, like watching the kid run off the lawn at the end of the movie after they say goodbye. And there's that look on Giamatti's face that's like proud of him, gonna miss him, but also envious of his youth as he bounds across the field, headed toward his future, quite literally. So yeah, there's a ton of father stuff in there in a way that I thought was really subtle and lovely. I thought that movie was great.
Yeah, I really loved it. And just in that scene that you're talking about, he's also kind of content because he knows he's actually done the right thing and he's done the thing that he's failed to do for such a long time. He's finally taking a step. He's finally confronting the things that have been making him feel so insecure as a man his entire life. So yeah, he's a kind of a heartwarming. Divine Joy Randolph, of course, is winning everything, and
yes,
good reason. Naveen Kumar, who's been on the podcast, New York Times critic, said that he thought that it was a terribly written role. Maybe he didn't say this in anything. I didn't read his review, but he said he was like, she was acting the hell out of a terrible role. I mean, I was like blown the fuck away by her performance, but it's weird that she doesn't experience any racism at all in the 70s in an elite white institution and then at a party full of white people. No racism, apart from the fact that obviously her son died for class and racial reason. Did anyone else feel like that about this, the race part of it at all?
I'm at the point with Divine Joy Randolph's awards season where she has given 18,000 speeches for good reason. She's won literally almost everything she could have won for this,
yeah,
which is cool. I've heard enough of her speeches. I've read enough of her interviews. Colleagues of mine have interviewed her. She loves the role and she stands by the role and its place in the ecosystem of that movie. And so I trust her on that. Is my kind of take
on
it.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I also thought she was so good. I hear you, Matt. I mean, I wonder that her role as a cafeteria worker in an elite boys prep school, like in and of itself, it's a job where a constant, you know, onslaught of like shitty behavior from shitty privileged children is a given. But I hear your point. And I also just want to say that Carrie Preston should have been fucking nominated. She was so good. She was so
good. I 100% agree.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Another snub, like an aggressive snub.
But that's the kind of thing where you watch her in that movie and you're like, man, Carrie Preston, always good, really good in this. But it's just, there's another big supporting actress performance in that movie. And they're probably, they weren't going to get two nominations out of it. But no, I agree. I vote in various awards bodies. And I did vote for Carrie Preston a few times in addition to Dave Vine.
So. She's so good.
Mm-hmm. I tried. That was what I'm saying.
That's awesome.
One thing I guess we haven't talked a ton about Poor Things. I thought,
I don't like to talk about the poor, Matthew.
Let's did keep get this your writer,
please.
I should have. I didn't read your writer this year. I should have.
Sorry, I watched Truman Capote and the Swans, and my brain broke. And now I'm coming to you from an Upper East Side French restaurant.
The cut under the table.
Eating a bowl of fish and cream, you know, whatever the hell they were eating.
Yeah, herring.
So gross.
Cod cheeks with salsa verde and fish
the
stock.
Acid reflux alone on that show. Don't get me started.
So I think Poor Things leaves us in a really great place at the end of it, as far as empowering a woman, totally and utterly putting male patriarchy and everything in its place, including a kind of grace for this tyrannical father that she had. There's something really like satisfying.
God.
There's something really satisfying about that. Biz, you texted about it. You were like, I love this film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I loved it. I mean, it was
done.
Done. I loved it. Bye. And that's that. Goodbye. Hang up. I did it. Well, it's a fairy tale and it's a building's roman. It's a story about someone growing up. But the fact that Emma Stone goes from playing a toddler to a fully formed adult who sort of has her mind cracked open by the human suffering of the world, she does it. She was phenomenal. It's an incredible movie. But I mean, if we're going to look at it from a tell me about your father lens, her father is gone. We're inventors.
As he is all of ours.
He is. Who is an omnipresent factor in our lives. But and then Mark Ruffalo is a sort of buffoon. You know, men are either totally controlling or disposable in a way that's really refreshing to see. There were a couple moments that I felt like were like the Barbie American Ferrera speech where I was like, you know, like it got a little too winky winky. But otherwise, I felt like it was a phenomenal movie. I loved every second of it. And just visually, holy shit.
There's some interesting writing out there about how Poor Things and Barbie are, from certain angles, the same movie.
Yes.
Just done very differently. Mm-hmm. Like a woman stumbling into the world of men and realizing all these things and kind of coming out the other side of it with a bit better understanding of herself and the world. And
while wearing incredible fashion.
That's exactly right.
The sleeves alone. You know, who will they cancel each other out for like creative direction, best direct, the visual stuff.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting.
They're so markedly different. Both are kind of in synthetic worlds, but in very different ways. Like one's Terry Gilliam and one is, Barbie.
I also loved, and I know that he didn't even really get credited. I like Jared Carmichael in this. I know
you're
that
the first person I heard say that.
Yeah. No, I like the idea of it. I like the idea of casting him in that role. As a gay misanthrope who's sort of hanging out.
Why would you relate to that, Matthew?
I mean, it's so escapist for me. I just like, how'd the other half live? No, but I don't know. It just, I liked it. And I was surprised that so many people really didn't like him. And I'm like, that's all he is. That's his routine. That's what they brought him in. It's not a big part. It's an interesting casting decision as far as casting goes.
I just wanted to say, like, I found this to be the most inventive and refreshing film-going experience. Like, just watching it was kind of delightful. But it's interesting that I would say that because it starts with the woman, Bella. You see that she has committed suicide and that God this mad scientist, Willem Dafoe, like brings her back to life just to see what would happen. An inherently, you know, horrible experiment, but especially because her character, it's about her sexual awakening. And I think that is part of the girlhood experience. As soon as you start talking, you start inserting objects into yourself. Yeah. And I'm just like, that's the story, you know, that they're telling. And I love how that Emma created her own language. That seems rare.
But that entire thing is placed next to a father who is entirely emotionally incapable of, he's not entirely emotionally incapable, but clearly been like wildly abused physically and emotionally. But his goal is to not pass that on. He is adamant that he will not allow this to go through him into his child, which is not common for men. Men are all fathers are almost entirely defined by the trauma that they indifferently throw onto their children. And it's sort of a, I don't know, it was kind of amazing in that way. Can we also, just before we get to the picks, Richard, your picks for winners, I would like to go back to Maestro really briefly. I want to read what you said about it, Richard, because it's one of your best quotes, I think, this year. You called it a romantic melodrama. We get a sketch of a marriage and a fainter sketch of an artist's path, neither as fully developed as one would hope for from such an ardently invested and exuberant film. Cooper, lifelong Bernstein fan, who has done a heap of research and then plucked out what he deemed the salient parts of the story, can't stay focused enough on one task. He is torn between sonorous hagiography and chiaroscuro marital watercolor, an ambivalence that dampens the film's potential impact. Quite. And
that was ChatGPT.
I also think it's like he just went, oh, because he's a failure emotionally as a father, but also he'd said, you know who I am, I'm this. And we also get a total blind spot with him as a man who is gay with a lot of power for other younger gay men. And we've got Gideon Glick in there as his sort of like aspiring protege. But it's amazing to me post-Tar that Leonard Bernstein as a sleazy man, which like I don't have evidence for, but I mean, you know, he was, I'm sure, to like hot young men that were in the studio or whatever. That just isn't even a part of it, really. He's like, oh yeah, I'm gay. That's right. You want to marry me? It's fine. And is that because Bradley Cooper's straight, ostensibly?
Well, partly, yes. But I think there's a recurring thing that happens with a lot of specifically music biopics, Bohemian Rhapsody, various others, that are made under the auspices of either the person themselves or their family. And they turn out kind of clunky and just, you know, paint by numbers. Like, then they started the band and then they rose to fame and then they crashed because they had their drug addiction and then they came out of it. And it's just the same story every time. And Maestro, at first glance, is this artful thing. It's half in black and white. It's sort of lyrical, big music, all this stuff. But if you pare that away, it is just a very polite movie made with Bernstein's family. And I think that precluded Bradley Cooper, even if he had wanted to, which I don't think he did, if he had wanted to go harder on some of that stuff and really give us a portrait of this complicated person, as all people are complicated, he wasn't really kind of almost allowed to, in a way. It's a polite movie because his family's right there watching.
It's so true. Yeah. And there's this quote that I keep seeing circulated from Bernstein's son that's like, I guess it's interesting that they were so involved in the making. And yet I think one of like the biggest damning remarks comes from Bernstein's son, which is, I learned nothing from watching this movie about my father and a lot about Bradley Cooper, like who Bradley Cooper is as a person, not about who my father was.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to what you were describing and what Matt read, that it's a confused film. You describe it as confused and it's the perfect description. And why not? I almost felt like at moments, of course, there's the conflict of his gayness and his marriage and the literal conflict that created in the marriage. But otherwise, I felt like there was this lack of like texture around who else he was as a person. Like, why not, as you point out in the review, talk about, you know, activism chic, the Tom Wolfe, you know, essay about going to the Bernstein's apartment and as a fundraiser for the Black Panthers. Like, why was that in the movie?
Yeah.
That's baffling to me, especially because Cooper, you know, he credits Carey Mulligan first in the film. the lead up to the movie's premiere at the Venice Film Festival was all, you know, like, no, just wait, you see, wait and see. Carey Mulligan is kind of the lead. It's really, you know, it's a real two-hander, you know. And then in the execution of the movie, you're like, so you excised a huge part of her life, which was her political activism, and then didn't give her much fleshing out in the other areas of her life that you do show in the movie. It's just like, what's going on here? I think he just really, when a filmmaker is really passionate about the subject or the book that they're adapting, they're so close that they kind of can't see it anymore. And I think that's what happened here. Yeah. I think it's like he the forest for the trees kind of thing.
I wondered, I didn't think of it that way. I thought of it as, is it because he's in it and directing himself too, which obviously he does in A Star Is Born, but I did not think A Star Is Born was a star. Aaron and I laughed through a lot of A Star Is Born. Williamsburg cinemas, which, while people wept around us and glared at us, it felt very unwieldy in places, but... Yeah, I wondered if maybe he needs to stop being in his own movies and just focus on directing.
I think that's definitely a fair assessment. And also, there's a real epidemic at the moment that a lot of talented directors also think they're writers. And not all of them are. You can't all be auteurs. You know, that's a really hard thing to do well. And you see a lot of, I think sometimes about like Emerald Fennell, where I'm like, I really want to see her direct someone else's script.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Maybe someone who knows how to, I don't know, end a movie, but.
What is happening with Bradley Cooper? I mean, I saw someone tweet, this is the strangest Oscar campaign I've ever witnessed, of these recent quotes that we put on the Tell Me About Your Father Instagram of him on Dax Shepard's podcast, right? Yeah. His indifference towards his daughter, which, okay, there are tons of parents out there that have said the same thing, but the way that it is delivered on the show, including the line about someone coming in with a gun and not feeling moved to protect his 8-month-old, I'm like, what are you saying? Stop talking.
I know.
Yeah, just don't say it.
I don't know if...
Totally normal.
I don't know if...
To think...
If you two or you three listen to the podcast Who Weekly.
Yes, of course.
But they increasingly are like, celebrities, stop going on podcasts. You keep saying crazy shit that gets taken out of context and gets or in context and then run in like People and Us and all that stuff. And it's just like these people are really like, you don't have to go on Dax Shepard's podcast. Exactly. Like, I swear you'll be fine if you don't.
Exactly.
I mean, this is Bradley Cooper feeling like wildly, wildly validated on his own terms and just so like minutes from getting everything he absolutely believes he deserves. So he's just like, I can say anything I want. I'm a god. I mean, it's sort of fun sometimes to watch men just do that because you're, I mean, unless they have power, just because you're like, oh, how stupid.
You did a little something, didn't you? Yeah, it's cute.
Yeah, look at you with your little award.
Oh, did you make a little movie? Oh.
Let's go through your picks for this year. Richard, let's start out not in order. Best director.
I think that's Nolan, without a doubt. I don't think there's anyone even close. My colleague on the Little Gold Men podcast, he thinks there's like some weird chance that Justine Triet wins for Anatomy because that movie is really beloved in Hollywood. But I don't know. I think everyone's just like, Nolan's overdue. He made the movie of the year in some people's estimation. Let's give it to him.
Okay. Best actor.
If you had asked me before the SAG Awards, I would have said that Paul Giamatti was going to win. Even though Cillian Murphy won the BAFTA, I was like, yeah, but he's from Ireland. He's more of a hometown person over there than he is here. But when Cillian Murphy won the SAG Award, I was like, okay, I think that he's just going to get swept up in the Oppenheimer momentum.
Same.
Okay. Best actress.
Tough. I think it looked like Emma Stone had a little bit of an edge on Lily Gladstone because of BAFTA, which Lily Gladstone was not even nominated for. I wonder where that might have had something to do with like category confusion. Like maybe people voted for her instead of supporting. I think Emma Stone also won the Critics' Choice Award. Not that those matter that much. But I don't know. I think that Lily Gladstone's speech at the SAGs was, and all of her speeches previous to that have been powerful. She has done a good but not overbearing job of reminding voters of the kind of political social importance of the film and her role in it and her role in the awards camp season. So I think people will go with that. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was Emma Stone.
It is shocking how much like the campaign after the film, like truly just like that's what you're basing this on is their speeches and who wins in the run up. It's sort of so delicate.
I think it's also interesting that like in the case of Gladstone and and Stone, the Stones, they apparently wear matching rings that Emma Stone
That's
gave
right.
them. Yeah. But that you have a subtle, quiet performance in Gladstone that's, you know, arguably more passive. Right. And then you have the Emma Stone performance, which is big and theatrical, et cetera, et cetera. I think ultimately, whatever the Academy voted for, it just came down to a matter of taste. You know, I don't think it's like about like skill or necessarily or whatever. It's just that like one is big and very involved and the other one is quieter, more subtle.
Good point.
Best supporting actor.
Robert Downey Jr., for sure. You know, I think that there's no one else in that category who's even maybe months ago Gosling would have been a competitor, but I think that moment passed a long time ago.
It sort of shocked me Sterling K. Brown was nominated. I really like him. I loved him in This Is Us. I liked him. I mean, I liked him in everything. He's so great, but like this film, really that role?
Well, him getting nominated there suggests to me that Cora Jefferson's going to win an adapted screenplay because it's like, okay, they really like that movie. If they nominated it, like Sterling, you know, two actors from it and the screenplay and the director, not the director, but the, you know, best picture. So I think Cora Jefferson's going to win, which is, you know, going to be the first.
Over Greta and Noah?
They're right at his heels, I think, but he's, I think, a little bit ahead at the moment, but I could be wrong.
Fascinating.
And would become the first former Gawker writer to win an Oscar.
I was going to say, like,
what about best supporting actress?
Davine. I mean, that she won that months ago, you know, like that she won that at Telluride.
So then best film is the question.
Oppenheimer is going to win. But the interesting thing about Best Picture for the last, I don't know, 10-ish years, they do this thing called, I think it's called a preferential ballot. And so you think about a year like Spotlight winning. My hunch is that Spotlight was a lot of number twos on people's ballots. And so the number one gets dropped off if it doesn't get enough votes. And then what's number two? Then that moves up to position number one when they're tallying everything. So I think there's a chance that enough people will have ranked Anatomy of a Fall, let's say, really high and Oppenheimer lower, that the math could get weird and Anatomy of a Fall could win. But I kind of don't think, that's what's going to happen because a lot of people like Oppenheimer across a lot of different demographics. So it's been clearer in years past where you're like, well, that person, the Spotlight person was not going to vote for The Revenant. You know, or those were the two going at it that year.
Is it possible to make sense of the fact that there are 10 best film nominees and 5 best directors? Like, how are you not the best director if you directed the best film?
Well, that is because the 10 films were made for ratings. Because when Inception did not get nominated for best, it's true. When Inception did not get nominated for best picture and there were all the Nolan people were out in the streets. The Academy and ABC was like, we need to have more populist films nominated.
Wow.
And when there's 5, it's, you know, that's much harder to do with a snooty brand like group like the Academy. And so they just expanded it for purely, I think, for viewer purposes. And so nothing else matches up with it, the director thing being the most glaring.
Isn't there a new category? Is it this year? Is it casting or are we not there yet?
That will be given out for the first time next to the movies of 2025.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
And I think my hunch is that stunt work is not far behind.
Louis Vertel was talking about on his podcast about how you've got to have more categories for sound. There's a whole set of people. I mean, Zone of Interest is an example of how sound, I mean, that film, as you said, this film is like a movie that is run by sound.
Mm.
You sit in the dark with howling chaos ramming into your skull for 5 minutes.
It's like being directed by Christopher Nolan with one of his loud-ass cameras.
Right, exactly. I think that they combined, because it was best sound, then they split it up into mixing and editing, sound mixing and sound editing, and now it's back to a combined category. Don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure that also has to do with ABC putting pressure. They're like, we cannot be giving out all these boring technical categories. We're either not going to air some of them or you need to reduce. And so they reduce there.
Got it. Well, that's what a wondrous note to end on. Reduce people because they're not that interesting to people in general.
Fair.
The cynicism of the Disney Corporation.
I don't care. It's feudalism. Like it's just about the person at the top and nothing else matters. How do they get there?
Another bacchanal.
It's another bacchanal. Richard, thank you for coming on once again. What a treat to talk to you about this.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
What do you want us to plug for you right now? Anything? Little Gold Men, your t-shirt line?
Yeah, I wrote a beautiful tribute to Billy Bush that is now on VF.com. Listen to Little Gold Men. Next week, we will be making our final predictions for... So Thursday, March 7th, we will have an episode where we do predictions. We also have a fun episode coming out 2 days previous to that, where we had listeners call in with their like favorite Oscar traditions and like, you know, themed menus and puns about, you know, movie titles and all that. I will say the one I came up with that I'm most proud of is Bar Bibimbap.
It's awesome. Oh, making me hungry.
So you can, yeah, you can make that or you can listen to me say it again on Little Ben.
Amazing.
That's an exclusive here too, because we're going to publish this before you publish that. So thanks for that.
God damn it. Yeah. Yeah. I also did Anatomy of a Falafel. So it's a deconstructed falafel. So it's like a chickpea salad. I like that one too.
That's too late now.
Yep.
Well done. So you're just throwing them out now.
That's right.
No, thanks once again for coming on.
Yeah.
Yay.
Thank you guys. It was fun.
This podcast was created and produced by Aaron Hosier, Elizabeth Thompson, and Matthew Philp. You can always listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google, and anywhere you get your shows. Follow us at Tell Me About Your Father on Instagram and Facebook. Subscribe to our bi-weekly newsletter that accompanies new episodes at tellmeaboutyourfather.com. And Apple Podcasts is like the New York Times book review of platforms. So if you can, go there to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think.